You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 98, covering the week of November 13th through November 17th, 2017. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, usual housekeeping. If you like this podcast, please share it around on social media. You can find the Abbeville Institute on social media. You can find it on Facebook at Abbeville Institute, on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, and our YouTube page where you can subscribe at Abbeville INST. If you don't want to go out and search for all those things, you can go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll find all our social media buttons, including our Amazon Smile button, where you can contribute to the Abbeville Institute simply by shopping at Amazon.com. You can make us your preferred charity. Also there, you can give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales Emancipation Hell, and you can get signed up for our daily email, The Daily Dose of Dixie, and our weekly email, The Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute, which includes a link to this podcast along with a bonus article. I also want to remind everyone that we do exist on your generous contributions alone, so if you do like what the Abbeville Institute does, if you want to help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. We have various levels of donation options, so just go on out to abbevilleinstitute.org at the top of the page, click on the tab that says Support, and you can find memberships for individuals or memberships for businesses or endowment options. We have several different options to give. Also, we have a conference now scheduled for 2018. February 23rd and 24th, 2018, we will be in North Charleston, South Carolina. The topic is going to be Confederate monuments and what they mean for America today. Our featured speaker is the Honorable Ben Jones, who is better known as Cooter from the Dukes of Hazzard. And we'll have several other speakers as well, so you can find information about that on our website. It's on the front page now, but you can sign up. The conference fee is $150. We do have a Meet the Speakers night the night before. If you want to pay a little extra for that, that's also available. So go on out to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, and find all that information. Okay, all that said, we have a very good week of material at the Abbeville Institute. I also want to say that next week we will not have a podcast. So the week of Thanksgiving, the Yankee holiday of Thanksgiving, because we know that Virginia had a Thanksgiving before New England, but we'll all be celebrating the Yankee holiday of Thanksgiving. There will not be a podcast or any material on the website, any new material next week, but we will be back the last week of November and first week of December. So just keep that in mind. If you're looking for a podcast, looking for material, won't have any up next week. So really good stuff, though, this week. We kind of did that on purpose. We had a number of very good articles, basically from our scholars this week. We did, sometimes we run material that's, or oftentimes we run material that's not from our associated scholars. And this week, every piece was from one of our associated scholars. So that's fun to do. We do that every now and then. But we had a lot of really good information. I think a lot of pieces that will make you think. And there was a theme in two of the pieces about the North, and a couple, one about James Madison, a book review written by one of our scholars, Joe Wolverton, and we had a wonderful little piece that ties into the other two pieces about the North by Boyd Cathy. And then the first piece of the week, which has caused a lot of discussion on social media, was a piece by Clyde Wilson, and it's entitled, Is the South Celtic? Now, this is a big topic, because there is a prevailing opinion that the South is dominated by what's called, quote-unquote, Celtic culture. Now, Dr. Wilson is presenting a different position here. It's not that he discounts the influence of what is called Celtic culture, though he does not understand what that exactly means. It's undefined, and if you ask people what Celtic culture means, that they have a hard time defining it. He's not discounting, though, the influence of the border regions of Great Britain, what's now Great Britain, from the influence of the South. And, of course, you can find this, and people often bring up bluegrass music, for example, which is very Celtic in its character. You know, if there was, back in the 80s, the band The Dubliners actually did a bluegrass album. They came over to the United States and they played bluegrass because they recognized that the that Celtic music and bluegrass music had a lot in common. So this is not to say that Celtic culture is not influential. If you read David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed, he talks about the Celts and their influence on the borderland regions of the South, but not just the South. They also had influence in places like Pennsylvania, moving into New York. So it's a larger swath of territory. And they came a little later in American history than did the English influence, which, if you study enough Southern history, you understand that the South really is a mosaic of various influences. Even in the British North American colonies, when you look at the English influence there, there is a different type of English influence, say, in the North than there is in the South, but it's distinctively English. And you look at the Tidewater region of Virginia, you look at the Lowcountry of South Carolina, you look at what was going on in those particular regions. It was heavily influenced by what Fisher calls Cavalier culture, which was not Celtic. And so you had that part of it. So if you look at Southern culture, the dominant cultures were Cavalier and Celtic in the border regions. But then you had a mix of other peoples as well. You had Germanic influences at times. For example, in Columbia, South Carolina, you had a heavy German influence, which is why they have their mustard-based barbecue. You have in French Louisiana, you have French Acadian influence. In certain parts of Florida, you had Spanish influence. And of course, you can't discount the influence of African culture in certain parts of the South as well, and of course, developing into this mosaic of Southern culture. So Southern culture is not Celtic, and when people say the majority of Southerners were Celtic, that's simply not true. You find a lot of Southerners who were of Celtic descent, but you also find a lot of Southerners who were not. And the dominant political culture, and even when it comes down to language, when you look at the language of the South, you can find there is a hybrid in many ways of Cavalier and Celtic language, or border region language, and also Cavalier language. But for example, the word ain't is often used by Southerners consternation of Northerners. But ain't was a popular slang term for the elite of English society during the time of Shakespeare. And so ain't was something that would come over from that particular portion of England, the southern part of England. And you can still find, as Fisher has found, in the southern part of England, a type of southern accent. If you look at, for example, when people often criticize the uneducated speech patterns of southerners, black and white, when they say things like, you know, they'll go into a discussion and they'll say, you know, I thought this, and you know, I did this, and you know. That use of you know was actually a part of Southern language. It isn't just because these people don't know anything or they're stuttering over their words. It's because that use of that you know came out of just common everyday usage, or y'all, which was something that Southerners still to this day use. Words like fixin', has a heavy Celtic origins, but even things like yonder, I'm going to go yonder, that's not Celtic in origin, that's more Cavalier in origin. So to talk about the South as being dominated by the Celts is to miss the heavy influence of other places, and not just that, it misses, in reality, the mixture of peoples in the South and the importance of what you would say would be English or Anglo-Norman influence along the coast of the South, and how important that was for the political culture in particular in developing these Southern colonies. So this piece irritated a lot of people. They didn't like the fact that somebody is saying, well, I mean, you know, maybe the South isn't Celtic. He's not saying that there isn't a Celtic influence there. He's not saying that Celtic culture is not important. What he's saying is the South is bigger than that. You can't just call it Celtic. It's not just a colony of Ireland or Scotland. It is a different, a much deeper and richer place. And I think that's important to understand. Because if you just make it, and what his criticism of Grady McGuinney's the Celtic culture or cracker culture, his criticism of that is that What they're doing is actually buying the Northern critique of the South, that somehow Southerners are just a bunch of backwards hayseeds, and he's using it as a badge of honor. And he's basically saying the South are all rednecks. And, you know, so we take that term, and of course, you know, Charlie Daniels singing "What This World Needs Is a Few More Rednecks," and people kind of like that nowadays. Yeah, that's funny, that's great, because, you know, rednecks have good values a lot of times. But what you're missing there is the Southern gentleman. The Southern gentleman that was not, would look down on the idea of a redneck. And we've had articles on this before, and how important it is to understand that concept of gentlemanly conduct. Now, there are negative sides of that. Of course, one of them is dueling, which is a violent and barbaric practice. But the idea of a gentlemanly code and proper conduct in public and private is something that is sorely needed in America today. And that's something the South can actually offer, the Southern tradition can actually offer to men, as we're seeing over and over again now in social circles and politics, the way that men conduct themselves, and also the idea of the Southern lady, which is sorely needed in modern American culture, because we have both men and women acting in ways that would have made Southerners blush, at least those of refined capabilities. They would have blushed at how men and women interact with each other today back in the 19th century. And so the idea of a lady and a gentleman, these are sorely needed concepts now in American history. And so I think that when you look at, you know, the idea of culture in the South, there are so many things you can talk about. And to make it some monolithic environment is to sorely undersell what the South offers. And so I think that's Clyde's position. It's not that he's critical of this idea of a Celtic South or influence of Celts in the South overall in terms of, you know, it being there, but he's critical of the fact that it's all Celtic. And, you know, when people say the vast majority of Southerners were Celtic, it's simply not true. All right, so that said, the piece on Tuesday was a wonderful review of Jeff Broadwater's biography of James Madison by Joe Wolverton. And Joe Wolverton is a Madison scholar. He's very interested in James Madison and what James Madison had to offer. And of course, the title of the piece is James Madison, Son of Virginia. And Madison was a son of Virginia. And this idea of what Virginia meant to the Union is often overlooked. And Calhoun actually said it best. He said, you know, when Virginia leads, we need Virginia to lead again. You know, I'm paraphrasing. Well, we need Virginia to lead again, because if that could happen, the Union would be in better shape. Virginia led the Union for decades. You look at, you know, the first five presidents, four were from Virginia. My favorite president in American history was from Virginia, John Tyler. And so when you look at Virginia leading, and you look at even the nationalists that led America in many ways, were also from Virginia. John Marshall from Virginia. Henry Clay was from Virginia originally, so, you know, later settled in Kentucky. So you look at the importance of Virginia and what that meant to America and how important that state was in many different ways, but certainly in the understanding of the original Constitution. And that's what he gets into in this particular piece. I like at the end of the piece, he talks a lot about the Virginia resolutions that Madison wrote. We talk about the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, but Madison wrote the Virginia component of that. And how Madison was essentially trying to inform people that, look, what we're doing in Virginia is consistent with the way the Constitution was sold to the states. And of course, Madison was part of that. That is the original Constitution. We often forget that when we talk about what the Constitution is. And I'm going to get into that with a piece that I wrote this week on Thursday, but it's part of it. But what the Constitution is, it was a compact between states, and there was an original understanding of what that compact meant. And that was actually defined by a Northerner, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, who at his State House Yard speech in October of 1787, just a few weeks after the Constitution was signed, said that, look, and I'm going to paraphrase here, the powers of the general government are limited and defined by the document itself, but the powers of the states are unlimited. They are limitless, except which is denied by the Constitution. So when you look at that particular argument, you look at the Constitution, and you look at the powers that are granted to the central government by the states, which ratified it, as Article 7 clearly says, there are very few there. The powers of the general government are limited by the document itself, though the powers of the states are only limited by Article 1, Section 10. In other words, the powers of the states are unlimited except what is denied by the Constitution. And when you look at that list of powers that are denied, it basically comes down to foreign policy and a few powers over commerce. That's because those powers were granted to the general instrument, to the general government. So what the states were, what the Constitution does is say, okay, the general government is going to handle these few and defined things, and the states won't do those things, but the states do everything else. And so I'll get into this argument on how that affects secession, for example, in just a minute. But this idea of Madison trying to hammer this home to the people of the United States through the Virginia resolutions, and this was a document that was presented to the states. If the people, if there's such a thing exists as the people of the United States, I like John Taylor of Caroline's position on that. You know, saying there's an American people is like saying there's a utopia for utopians. It just doesn't exist. But Madison is trying to publicly say, now of course nobody knew he wrote it at the time, but Madison is trying to publicly say, look, what we have here is an original constitution, an original understanding, and this is it. And the states are as much part of interpreting this constitution and protecting their citizens, protecting the fabric of the compact, as any other institution in America. The only power that can check a government is another government. That's something that we often forget in America as well. There's no branch of government that can check the power of a government because a branch of the same government is still a branch of that government, and it can be complicit. And people will say, well, you know, the Supreme Court will always be there to stop unconstitutional legislation. So, really? And so it's not much to say a slippery slope if the Congress passes a law that's unconstitutional, the president signs it, and then the Supreme Court upholds it. What do you do about it then? And people say, well, that doesn't happen. It doesn't. We just had, for example, the Affordable Care Act in the last decade that was clearly unconstitutional. The Congress passed it. The president signed it. The Supreme Court upheld it. Even a Supreme Court that was supposed to be a quote-unquote safeguard of the Constitution, they upheld it being constitutional. There is a vast, perhaps minority of Americans, but certainly a vocal minority that says that law is unconstitutional, regardless of what the Supreme Court said. So then what do you do? Becomes the question. Do you just live with it? Let's say the Congress passed a law that was so blatantly unconstitutional that restricted free speech. The Congress passed it, the president signed it, and the Supreme Court refused to do anything about it. You can say, well, that wouldn't happen. It doesn't. We had it in 1798, the Sedition Law, which was against a free press and free speech and designed to curtail free elections. And so Jefferson and Madison are saying, well, the only entity that can stop it now would be the states. We just won't enforce it here in our borders. And in so many ways, the Supreme Court has said that that's the case when the states don't have to enforce federal law. The federal law enforcement cannot force state law enforcement to enforce their laws. This is non-commandeering. So the federal government can pass a law, but they don't have enough law enforcement officials to enforce everything. So the states can just say we refuse to enforce it. And that's what you're seeing with things like marijuana laws in places like Colorado and Washington State. It's just that the state and local officials, law enforcement officials, are just refusing to enforce that law. The federal government still says these things are illegal, but they don't have enough law enforcement officials to ensure that these things are prosecuted. So the state just says we're not enforcing it anymore, and we're going to decriminalize. And so that's the important part of understanding where the states work in this. It's not that this is somehow un-American to advance these positions. It's completely American. It's the original understanding of the Constitution. And so I think Joe Wolverton does a nice job in bringing that out. So that said, we had a piece on Wednesday by Boyd Cathy talking about this issue with General Kelly and also Lee and cultural Marxism. And so when you look at this position of what General Kelly had said. And I'm sure everyone knows by now what General Kelly said. He went on the Ingram Angle, which is Laura Ingram's new show on Fox, and he basically had some nice things to say about Robert E. Lee. And the leftist historical profession went nuts over this. How can a guy say that? Particularly a couple of Ivy League professors, Stephen McCurry and David Blight, who came out and said, well, I mean, this is just completely preposterous. These guys were advancing, Lee and others were traitors. They were committing treason. And to say that compromise could have avoided this, the South refused to compromise. Compromise couldn't have avoided anything. Now, what's funny about that, and this is not in the piece, but McCurry and Blight themselves have actually written that it was a lack of compromise that led to the war. This is the exact same thing Kelly had said. Look, nobody was willing to compromise. And there were also, the problem I have with that position with McCurry and particularly McCurry, I'll just say McCurry, they fail to recognize that it was the North that was refusing to compromise over and over again. The South is actually willing, and they often place the blame on the South. The South refused to compromise. In fact, that's what she said. Well, the South wouldn't compromise. The South is the ones who wouldn't compromise. This is simply not true. The Committee of 13, which was established to sift through all the compromise proposals that had come out of the Congress, namely the Crittenden Compromise, which was the most famous, it was presented to that committee. And Jefferson Davis, who was the head of that committee, would have agreed to the Crittenden proposal. But when he found out, he had a policy of dual majorities. When the Republicans on the committee, there were five of them, refused to support any compromise measures at the urging of Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson Davis and Robert Toombs of Georgia switched their vote and voted against the proposal. So it was a 7-6 defeat. So it's amazing to me how this burden of compromise is often placed on the South, that they were unwilling to compromise over and over again. But really, it was the North that took the position of the unwillingness to compromise that actually led to the war. Lincoln could have stopped the war over and over again. He could have accepted South Carolina commissioners and offered to sell or negotiate some type of sale of property. There didn't have to be war. Lincoln, though, chose his party over union in many ways, and he chose violence over peace. Lincoln chose that position, and I think that we often forget that Lincoln was as much involved in this policy of bringing about the war as anything the South did. Now you can say, well, if the South hadn't seceded, there wouldn't have been any war. Well, okay, the South seceded, right? But in 1860, only South Carolina had left the Union. If Lincoln had shown at that point, if there was any inkling that there was going to be some compromise, you may not have seen the secession of any of the other Southern states. There were people in the South, cooperationists, there were people who were willing to look at the situation and say, well, maybe secession is a little too rash at this point. But when it became clear that the Republicans and Lincoln in general, in particular, I should say, would not compromise, then they, in their mind, they were left with no recourse but to leave the Union. So, and of course, then people are going to say, well, the compromise was over slavery. Well, the compromise was over slavery extension. And so we can talk about, why slavery was important, and that was the issue. And we're actually going to get into that in a minute with Don Livingston's piece on Friday. But the compromise wasn't over the moral outrage of slavery. That never was the situation. It was always over the extension of slavery for political means. This is the Michael Holt position that's often ignored now, completely ignored by the mainstream historical profession. But I think that Michael Holt has hammered home the importance of slavery within a political context. And that political context means power. So it's important to understand this bigger picture of secession and what it actually meant, rather than narrowly defining it in a particular way. This is preposterous. Lee was no traitor. The failure to compromise led to the war. As Boyd Cathy points out, a number of historians for years have said this. And not just that. I mean, this was the general position for years. So what we're looking at now is a battle over interpretation, not fact. Even though those who are putting up forward an interpretation now fail at times to even acknowledge their own writings that said failure to compromise was part of the war. So this is same thing General Kelly had said. And to say good things about Robert Lee now is considered almost, heresy because Lee was a traitor. And I'll talk about that position in a minute. But as Boyd points out, a number of historians, namely Eugene Genovese in recent years, have said, look, the modern historical profession is missing what the South can offer, what the Southern tradition can offer to America. This is why the Abbeville Institute exists. I I don't know, but I believe that if Genovese was still alive, he would have been sympathetic to the Abbeville Institute. And look at the true and valuable parts of the Southern tradition and what that can bring to America. In fact, he said that the South offered the only real critique of liberal industrial capitalism in American history. So this is an interesting position, but one that is ignored by the modern historical profession. Okay, so on Thursday, let me get to this thing about this idea of treason. The piece I wrote on Thursday is entitled The Extreme Northern Position, because I think that's what we have to understand here. What Blight and McCurry are offering is the extreme northern position. It's often said that secession is the extreme southern position, which it really wasn't. I mean, it is an American tradition. Secession was not an extreme position at all. Various groups had advocated secession for years, mostly in the North, actually, in the early founding period, and then moving, and then it migrated to the South. But the first and second generation of Americans, and even the third generation of Americans, obviously because they pulled it off in the South, all believed secession was legal. This was not treason. And if you look at the historical record, that becomes very clear. But using this term treason to define secession, and I see this all the time. People will say, they'll cite the article of the Constitution that defines treason, which is actually in Article 3 of the Constitution. And they'll say, well, the South was committing treason because it was waging war against them. Now, you could actually make a case that if Lincoln is saying that the Union still exists, then he's actually committing treason because he's waging war against them. He's the one that marched troops into the South, into the Southern states, which he's saying are still in the Union, but yet he does not have the authorization from any of the states in the South to march troops into those states. That is also required by the Constitution. So Lincoln's legal argument had a lot of holes in it. But this whole idea that secession was treason is clearly not true. And let me explain why. And it actually goes back to that original understanding of the Constitution I talked about just a few minutes ago. And that is, the powers of the states were limitless except what is prohibited by Article 1, Section 10. If you look at Article 1, Section 10, there is no restriction on states leaving the Union. It does not say a state cannot secede. Now, it does say states cannot form confederacies with one another, but that's only if they're within the Union, right? So, I mean, that language is actually lifted from the Articles of Confederation, and people don't often realize how much of the Constitution, how much of the language of the Articles actually found its way into the Constitution. But that language comes from the Articles of Confederation, and it was there because what they didn't want is if the states were in the Union to have a union within a union. That's not something they wanted. What they wanted, I mean, obviously the founding generation thought that you could dissolve the Union because they dissolved the Articles of Confederation without a unanimous consent and formed the Constitution. Now, it was the same union of states, but a different governing document. What would happen to the states that refused to ratify the Constitution? Could they still be could they still be operating under the Articles of Confederation? Absolutely. Absolutely they could. And so this was a different union. These states essentially, in a way, seceded from the Articles and formed a new union of states that had a little stronger central authority. So this whole idea that secession is illegal is based on a misunderstanding, or secession is treason, is based on an entire misunderstanding of the Constitution. The concept of the Constitution, the concept of the compact, which is clearly articulated by Article 7, it's between the states so ratifying the same type of union that existed under the Articles. All of this, these people don't really understand what they're talking about. In other words, they don't know what they're talking about, and they're advocating and advancing a position that shows their complete stupidity when it comes to the understanding of the Constitution by the founding generation. And if the founding generation thought secession was illegal or treason, why did they start advancing that position, members of the founding generation, as early as 1794, when Oliver Ellsworth and Rufus King cornered John Taylor of Carolina in a cloakroom in the Senate and said, hey, look, we want out. What do you think? The North should just secede. So the idea that that secession is treason is the extreme northern position that was advanced during the war and then thereafter. Not until the war did you have anyone saying secession was treason. It was only during the war, and that was the extreme northern position. I say it's the extreme northern position because still the majority of Americans didn't think that way. Certainly, there were Americans fighting to save the Union, but they weren't calling secession treason necessarily. And we know the majority of Americans did not think secession was treason because a crushing majority in the South voted for secession, and a substantial minority in the North was against Lincoln's program. We know this because he got only got 55% of the Northern vote in 1864. So 45% of Northerners didn't agree with Lincoln's position and would have favored a peaceful resolution of the conflict, meaning recognition of the South, that secession was not just de facto, but also de jure. And when you look at this idea of legitimacy and self-government, all these things factor into it. So this idea that secession is treason is a completely un-American statement. It's not just stupid, it's un-American. And I think that's something that needs to be called out. This is the extreme northern position that these people are advancing. Just like you have the deep north rather than the deep south. We need a northern studies program to study the peculiarity of northerners and their peculiar positions on things, because their positions are peculiar. They were not held by the majority of Americans. And getting that said, the last piece gets into this as well, and Don Livingston's piece on John C. Calhoun and what he meant by, was slavery a positive good? So Dr. Livingston, who is, of course, the president of the Institute, outlines that slavery was a national enormity, a national wrong. It wasn't just a Southern wrong. It was a national wrong. And so he says, look, the problem was that nobody knew what to do with it. Nobody knew how to, and the founding generation didn't know how to end slavery humanely. And he says the humane thing would have been a national policy of emancipation followed by compensated emancipation and then some type of integration strategy so that former slaves would not be abused when they were being integrated into society. And nobody had a program for this. No one, North or South. Abolitionists simply just said end slavery and then bring and use violence to do it. Well, that's not a humane thing to do. Because you're looking at what John Brown did, for example, at Pottawatomie Creek, just slaughter slave owners, or lead some type of insurrection where people are slaughtered. This is what we've gotten to. Well, people are saying, well, that's justified. And this is why, you know, a statue of Nat Turner is being considered in Virginia. I mean, that Nat Turner was a terrorist. So this is preposterous. But what he's saying is that Calhoun's position that he wasn't actually saying slavery itself was a good, but because he said, you know, I wouldn't say death is a good thing or luxury is a good thing. They're the same type of thing. But what he's saying is that the North is advocating a morally irresponsible position because they're not coming up with anything to replace it with. They're not coming up with a way to get rid of it that would be humane for everyone involved. So that was Calhoun's position. Slavery as it is, and with the alternatives, he's not saying, and he said this in his speeches, I'm not saying that, you know, slavery itself is a positive good, but slavery as it exists at the time. So we look back at this, and of course, Calhoun's words are now twisted and taken out. This guy's the defender of slavery, as Samuel Flagg Bemis called him, with Calhoun with his hair slicked back and looking, you know, his eyes sunken because he has tuberculosis, he's about ready to die. This is what we have of Calhoun. But that's a intellectually irresponsible position to take. It doesn't fully grasp Calhoun's position. And the idea that slaves, and Calhoun actually said that, look, over time, slaves could be integrated into society. They are perfectly capable of this. They need to be brought into society just like everyone else. And now this position, people would say, well, that's just racist. That's looking down on people. This is what everyone thought. And of course, Lincoln never said anything positive, particularly before the middle of the 1860s, about black Americans. In fact, Lincoln's policy was keep them out of the North, as Dr. Livingston nicely points out in this. So again, this is a study, the Northern Studies Institute would examine how Northerners themselves wanted to keep blacks out of the North because they didn't want them there for a variety of reasons. Illinois had laws on the books prohibiting free blacks from living in the state. So this wasn't just a Southern position. This idea of, you know, and as we've talked about in this podcast before, the United States overall was hostile to black Americans. It wasn't just the South. And he says, you know, the South really wasn't hostile to black Americans because they lived there. In fact, the South is more integrated and more intimate between the races than anywhere else. And this is actually pointed out by Republicans. In fact, Republicans in the period leading up to the war and the election of 1860 often criticized Democrats for being the party of miscegenation because they said these people are down there, there's all these mulattoes down there, obviously this is race mixing, and so we don't want that here in the West, we don't want that in the North, we need to keep the blacks in the South because that would ruin the white race in the North. And so when you look at, Don brings up a Republican committee during the war said that, you know, we need to keep the United States for the Anglo, Celtic, you know, and Scandinavian, Germanic people of the North. We need to ensure that that's what we have. We want to keep the blacks bottled up in the South because that's where they belong, down there with these Southerners who mix with them all the time. And, I mean, that was the Northern position. So, again, the Northern position was race. Southerners who, you know, lived around blacks all the time, had much more familiar relations with them than anyone in the North really did at all. So it's this twisted version of American history that we often get that demonizes the South and places the North on a pedestal which doesn't really belong, and really it's a cartoonish understanding of American history. And I think that's the problem. There's no complexity. There's no nuance anymore. It's just talking points. It's David Blight and Stephanie McCurry with talking points. Treason, treason, slavery, treason. That's all you get. And in their own writings, they ignore those positions. But you get them in a soundbite for the Washington Post. You get them to give us a comment on what General Kelly said. Well, that's treason and slavery. I mean, I could just write everything that these people say. What do you think about General Lee? Treason and slavery? Oh, yeah, well, what about the South in 1861? Well, I'll tell you about that. It was treason and slavery. What do you think about the Confederate soldier? Well, obviously, it was treason and slavery. In fact, I'm just going to write a book where every chapter is entitled Treason and Slavery, and then it'll be like The Shining, you know, where Jack is there writing his book, going insane, and it's all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. I could just write Treason and Slavery is the South, Treason and Slavery is the South, over and over again, and that would be the book, because if you read these books, that's essentially what you're getting now. You could just, it's like a cookie cutter. Here, we're going to have the book, and it's going to say Treason and Slavery, and then we're going to write everything Treason and Slavery. It's intellectually dishonest and it's intellectually weak, but this is what we've gotten now. So, there you go. I think this week was a really good week of the Institute. A lot of food for thought, a lot of intellectual ammunition, a lot of stuff to chew on. And that's why, you know, we did this week because we're taking off next week. So you got a lot of stuff lingering into the week and we'll be back in full force on November 27th. The week after Thanksgiving. We'll see you then, and we'll see you next time. Hope you enjoyed this one. Until next time, good day.